Well, hello again, and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. My name is Jake D. Steele, and I'm your host. And today, we have author Bart Windrum, who, during the demise of his parents in 2004 and 2005, functioned as a key family member and medical power of attorney. Repetitive, disturbing, and harmful experiences during those times inspired him to examine, research, contemplate, and clarify the nature of hospitalized dying in America from the patient-family perspective. And it's my pleasure to welcome Bart Windrum to Authors Audio. Good afternoon, Bart, and welcome to Authors Audio. How are you doing?
Hi, Jake. Thanks for having me on.
Your book, Notes from the Waiting Room, Managing a Loved One's End-of-Life Hospitalization, is a very detailed compendium about the many considerations a person must deal with in caring for a loved one at the last stages in their life. Perhaps, for starters, you could tell our audience a little bit of how you came to write this book.
Well, it was born of personal experience, Jake. And as far as I can condense it, in January of 2004, my mother took unexpectedly seriously ill, wound up almost immediately intubated in an ICU. And at that point, my father was alive. They had been married 60 years. Everyone expected him to go first because he had a batch of problems, including heart problems and others. So it was a big shock to the whole family. And my role at that point was as an adult child, as was my sister's. In 2005, 15 months later, my dad took a turn for the worse and had what we call a medical crash, also unexpected. And at that point, my sister and I were medical powers of attorney. We had a lot of problems in my mom's hospitalization, and we thought we had learned the ropes as a result of living through that experience, that three-week experience. And we encountered a raft of the same sort of problems, different details, but the same essential nature during my dad's terminal hospitalization. And we were both pretty aggrieved by this. And when I got back home, I sat with it for a while, and then I started talking to people. And I wanted to understand whether our experiences were just a pair of unfortunate anomalies, or if they represented a norm. And to both my dismay and my, I'll say delight, it's sort of an odd word to use, but my comfort, shall I say, in terms of writing a book, I got the green light because all the medical professionals I talked to indicated to me that our experiences were unfortunately a real possibility in any hospital anywhere in the country for anybody.
Bart, your book does cover many, many important details of all the ramifications of hospitalization for your loved one. I think one of the most important ones you do bring up is the idea of power of attorney, and maybe you'd just like to touch on that for our viewers.
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I should say also, when I thought about how to organize the book, I, with some regret, after the introductory material, led with being a personal representative and being a power of attorney and all what that means. And I say with some regret because it's not really the meat of the book, but it is so important. It is imperative, at least down here in the States. And I'm going to assume to at least a degree, or if not an equal degree, in Canada. If you don't have your legal ducks in a row, you leave yourself open to losing control. I'm not saying that it's bound to happen. In many cases, it would not happen. But in the worst possible cases, it could happen. And down here, the Terry Schiavo case of a couple of years ago was a classic example of the length to which losing control or being challenged on control can stretch out. But the fact is, unless you are legally recognized as someone who can speak for a loved one, that is, in medical circumstances, which is called a medical power of attorney, and unless you are recognized as someone who can conduct the financial and worldly affairs of a loved one, that's referred to as a property or financial power of attorney, you could be challenged. And sometimes you need those docs, period, to be recognized as someone that the providers and the representatives of the system, shall we say, will recognize you. And without those documents, you run the risk of not being recognized. And if you are not recognized by the people in the system, you lose control.
Oh, I agree with you 100% on that. You have to have a clear definition of what your role is in the care of your parents or your loved one. You really have to have that.
Well, it's interesting. A clear definition. There are a couple of parts of that. We've just, you know, identified the legal part of that. That requires that specific forms be signed. They're probably unique to each state in the union. But there's also having a clear definition in your own heart and mind. And that's equally, actually, more important because that's what you live with. You know, you need to understand what a loved one's outlook is and what their desires are and be able to represent their desires, not your own or not a sibling's or not a doctor's, people who may have different viewpoints. Right? You have to understand what your loved one wants. And that is subject to change.
Right, exactly. Well, you talk about living wills also.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to just go into that very briefly?
Yeah.
What that is?
A living will is a document that sets forth what you do and do not want to happen medically in crises, generally around resuscitation issues and end-of-life issues. Sometimes called an advance directive, these forms can be obtained from a lawyer. They can be obtained online. There's one in general use called Five Wishes, which attempts to put a more human face or presentation on this range of options that you might set forth. California actually is creating a very, very user-friendly form that sort of leads the reader through the choices and to some extent what they might mean. But what an advance directive is intended to do is set forth yours or you know, a loved one's who would, you know, he or she would execute one for him or herself, to set forth an individual's general guidance about the medical treatment they do and do not wish to have.
Right, right. Yeah, so that their wishes are being taken care of.
Well, honored, I would say, and acted upon. Right, taken care of is a little vague, but the real crux is we want our wishes to be recognized by the providers and those with legal responsibility in the system and acted upon by them.
Yes, your book is, of course, based on a lot of your experience that you've had with your parents, and you get into a subject regarding how to best manage hospitalization of your loved ones, and perhaps we could just touch on that because I know you get into it quite extensively in your book.
Yeah, Jake, actually, let's go into this a little bit because it's huge and the ramifications are so profound. Hospitals advertise to us that they provide care. That's what we expect. When a loved one is ill, we all have experience in caring for them. Caring is a human endeavor. We experienced it when we were young as children, and our mothers and fathers cared for us in our bedrooms. As parents, for those who are parents, we do the same for our children and for our significant others and spouses and brothers and sisters. We know what care is, and it consists of both treatment and it consists of human attention and proximity. Hospitals, in general, advertise to us that they provide care, and they do this through a variety of ways. And the primary way is what I call the happy couple image. A couple of years ago when I was researching all this and researching the books, because I wanted to understand why did we have these experiences that we had in the hospitals? What went wrong? And one of the first things that went wrong is our expectations. Our expectations weren't being met. No one was telling us really what to expect and what we had to do as part of the system, because we individuals are part of the system. And so when after all these events happened and I started looking into this, I realized, you know, what happened here with our expectations? And I realized that we were expecting care. I was sitting in the dentist's office one day, and one of the major national weeklies, I think Newsweek or Businessweek, I forget which, you know, they have an annual health care issue. So I was in the dentist's office waiting room, thumbing through this, and I saw all these advertisements. And a great many of them had what I call the happy couple. It was the husband and wife on the golf course or at the poolside. There was one with the father and the daughter in the classroom, and on the chalkboard was the legend, "My dad's heart operation." If you go on websites, you may see a happy couple, some indeterminate couple at the on the top banner graphic of the webpage. I saw one with a man and a woman dancing down the hallway. And the woman was obviously a citizen, and the man was dressed in a nondescript sort of blue coat that had kind of a medical cut to it. It sort of inferred doctor, you know, without exactly saying so. And all these images say to us, we provide loving care, and we restore you to your life and those that who love you and you love. Another way hospitals communicate or try to communicate with us is they hang banners from the building. Some are in the cafeteria, you know, 100 best hospitals. And if you look at the small type, it could be, this is true, by the way, 100 best hospital, one of the 100 best hospitals to work in the country by Mother's Magazine assessment. The banner that hung off the side of the building that my dad was hospitalized in also said 100 best. And I didn't know what it meant. And this thing is like a billboard. They're huge. You see them from the roadway. And eventually I learned that it was designated as one of the 100 best hospitals in the country, according to JCO, the Joint Commission, which accredits hospitals based on a batch of technical criteria, shall I say. The problem isn't only that hospitals tell us they provide loving care, but they don't. They provide something else, which I'll describe in a minute, but they simultaneously withhold from us the most vital and critical information that a patient family needs to know in order to manage a hospitalization. And there's a lot we need to know to manage the hospitalization. So that's the first point, the point of entree, or even before we get to the hospital. What do we expect from these places? Are we naive? And I answered that question eventually saying, no, we're not naive. We're vulnerable. And we have real expectations about what needs to happen.
Well, very often what happens is if someone has a heart attack or an emergency and they're taken to the hospital in an ambulance and so on, that the decision on which hospital to go to is made by somebody else usually. Depending on the critical nature of the individual, so they race to some hospital, and then later on, you get to find out through dealing with a hospital just how good it is or not good it is as it relates to your patient care there.
One of the things that I touch only tangentially on in Notes from the Waiting Room is the distinction between hospitals, because there are distinctions and they are important. My book at 336 pages, I felt that I didn't want to delve into that, and I do have an annotated bibliography in the book and refer with many reviews of some of the books that I found most useful, enormously useful. And there are others that do describe the differences among hospitals. But for our conversation now, there's two important points. One is that we are equally at risk in any hospital anywhere in the country. This assessment from a variety of folks that I interviewed early on, and who some of whom were also readers of my manuscript a little over a year ago. These include emergency room nurses, unit nurses, chaplains, mission directors, you know, people in the ethical, who apply the ethical realm in the hospital.
Yes, and in your book also you mentioned that you did talk to a lot of people, but one of the most interesting things I found was that you could not get an interview from a hospital administrator.
No, I could not. And this was really interesting because I was referred to several hospital administrators through personal referrals. My financial planner, for instance, one of his clients who's become a friend, is a VP of a large hospital in Metro Denver. And and another, my book coach, actually, my publishing coach, she's consults to the nursing field. And one of her dear friends is a COO of a hospital, or was, you know, on the East Coast. And these two people did the groundwork. They said, you know, we have a guy who's writing a book, I'd like to talk with you. Can he contact you? And they both said yes. And I did, and they never replied. But I did learn some things administratively by the by. And I should say also, I want to say this sort of early on in our conversation, is that by all accounts, I have written a balanced book. And I really kept that in mind. I don't name names in the book. It's not about blame. It is about assigning responsibility. And since I am part of the system, and I failed at key moments in the system, the finger points 360 degrees. And I assign responsibility unflinchingly to myself as a player in these events. But sometimes I lose my train of thought because these threads run pretty long.
That's okay. No, we're this is a live conversation. We're not worried about that. Everybody does that. One of the things that maybe you could, when speaking for the listeners, is maybe you could go through what general things a person should get to know about the hospital that their loved one is in. What are the most important things that they should know?
I've broken this out into two categories for the content that I put in my book, which again is represents, I don't know, maybe 50% of all what you need to know to manage a hospitalization. The two categories are day-to-day and planning and ethics. So here's the list for what you need to know on a day-to-day basis. Is the hospital a family-friendly environment? Because, this is important because actually the term family care during hospitalizations means that your family must provide the care. One of the things that we learn as we hang around during a loved one's hospitalization is that doctors don't provide care, they provide treatment. And hospitals don't provide care, they provide treatment under the direction of independent physician scientists. In most cases, not all, but most cases, the doctors are independent. They have their own practices or group practices, and they are given what's called privileges to practice at one or more hospitals in a community. So they come and go on their own schedule. Nurses provide monitoring, but they don't provide care by and large. And what happens is that because of the corporatization of hospitals, and the nursing staff has really taken the hit. You know, they'll throw in million-dollar machines, but they'll reduce their nursing staff as well.
So you're saying that nurses don't provide care?
I'm saying that the way nurses' jobs run is that they have to monitor a range of patients. So if you go to a nursing station, especially in a critical care unit, you know, you've got computer screens that'll show the machine readouts, you know, all the criticals that are going on in each patient's room, and the nurses know when procedures need to be performed or when medications need to be administered and like that. But other than that, it's not like they're going to be floating around a whole lot. You might be sitting around in a room with your loved one for an hour or so or more without a nurse coming in. You know, there's a lot of downtime, a lot of quiet time. The technicians have been hired, people who may have only a few weeks of training, to perform a very narrow and discrete task. And they may come in and do it. And everybody's supposed to communicate via the patient chart, right? That's what the pros use to record what is happening and ostensibly to read through and communicate with one another through the entries that they make in the patient chart. But it's not like being at home where, like when I was a kid, I had a little bell, right? And if I needed something, I'd ring the bell. Well, I guess the hospital equivalent is the call button, but it's not like someone is there. I mean, after all, to be fair, you have a hall full of patients, right? But the nursing, the staff ratio, the nurse-to-patient ratio has gone down. That is, fewer nurses for more patients. So that's another piece. That's what I call a gaps in nursing services. In our case, to bring this home, right, because this is all what's in my book is not theory. It's what we experienced and I subsequently reflected on. In my dad's case, you know, he went in for pacemaker testing, which in his case, he had advanced heart disease anyway. He was 84, felt himself weakening. So that testing would not be getting on a treadmill like, you know, young guys like you and I would do. It's chemical testing. You can't put an 84-year-old who's already on a walker, you know, on a treadmill. So he had some kind of problems, and we don't know exactly what they were, but the upshot was that he wound up debilitated and with a couple of infections. One was hospital-borne through catheterization, and that stuff is well known. Another one wound up to be a blood infection that could have been intrinsic to his physiology at his time in life, or it could have been hospital-borne, too. We don't know that either. But the upshot was, you know, here's a guy who was cheerful. He was elderly, but he was cheerful. He got around every day, went out in his scooter, got in his van, drove around town, went to restaurants, and he rolled himself into the hospital. 6 days later or less, you know, 5 days later, he's flat on his back and crying in his room. So my sister flies in, and half a week later, I fly in because things are really serious. And we learned that he had not been eating or drinking. It wasn't because he wasn't hungry and thirsty. It was because of gaps in care. There was a hole in the system. Despite the nurses, despite the techs, he wasn't getting fed because he couldn't lift the spoon. His one arm was IV'd to the hilt, and the other arm is where he had this wrist infection. Nobody knew it was a wrist infection yet. He was extremely painful. He couldn't use the arm, and he couldn't lift a spoon. He needed to be fed. We had to hire people to come in at night because we couldn't stay there all night with him. We had to hire people out of our own pocket, $240 a day or something, to do an overnight shift and stay with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
That's a gap in nursing service. Now, I'm not... Yeah. Now, I should say also, and before we go down this list, I should say that it is entirely possible to have a good hospitalization anytime, whether it's for a surgery at some point, the kind of getting out, or if it's an end-of-life hospitalization. But the odds are equally or greater stacked against that happening. The likelihood is that there will be one or more sets of problems. And what I'm sure we'll get to in a few minutes is how terrible those problems can be at the end of life, because there are no second chances at the end of life.
Now, how easy is it for you or anyone in this situation to get the appropriate information from the hospital staff? Is that an easy thing, or can it be quite difficult?
It is if you know how to get it. So the first answer to the question is, in my experience, it was extremely difficult to get that information. The only way we really got the information was to ask for some of it. But you don't know what to ask for. Right, and this ties into what I mentioned a few minutes ago, that hospitals don't tell us, by and large, what we need to know, these vital and critical things. Now, it may be out there in a brochure, but if you fly in from 2,000 miles away a week into your loved one's hospitalization that no one is expecting, and it takes 10 hours to go door to door, and you get in at 1 in the morning, and you wake up the next day at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you get to the hospital, the last thing you're going to do is sit around and read paper, right? So there's no guidance about the many things. What is hospital time, right? It's this unique time zone. How does time flow in a hospital? When do people come and go? What is the responsibility of this doctor or that doctor? What is their relationship to one another? Who is an RN, and who is a nurse practitioner, and who is a technician? And what are their legal and legitimate roles that they play? And how do they interact with one another and with you? How do you understand and verify what treatment is being proposed for a loved one and what its ramifications are and what in medical terminology are the benefit versus burdens of the treatment? What do you do if there's a problem? And most critical, Jake, is this whole thing. I have a whole 30-some-odd page chapter on the ins and outs of resuscitation, what I call the ethical gray zones around resuscitation technology and decisions. This is huge, and none of this information is provided to us. We have to think to ask moment to moment and begin to synthesize the answers.
Right. I was going to get into that, this whole business of that. And would you like to just speak to that for just a minute, what you found out about all that?
Well, a minute.
I know that, well, briefly.
Yeah.
Just briefly.
Resuscitation, here's the key thing to know about resuscitation. First of all, whether or not you're resuscitated, if you need resuscitation, goes right back to where we spoke a few minutes ago about having the medical power of attorney and advanced directives, advanced planning documents, ready, prepared. And it also means that you've had conversations with your loved one around the dinner table and strolling the beach or the mall. Another thing about resuscitation, which is huge, is that to my simple lay mind, resuscitation is very simple. If you will die without it, it's life support, right? So resuscitation is about maintaining life. So it's the application of life support technology. Without it, you will die of respiratory failure or cardiac failure, heart failure, if you are not resuscitated. So cardiac, if you have cardiac arrest, well, they could put paddles on you or do chest compressions and all like that. If you have respiratory arrest, you need to be ventilated or intubated. They'll shove a tube down your throat, maybe try a mask over your face first, and ultimately would throw a tube. It's called intubation. It goes down your trachea, and a machine will pump air in and out of your lungs. But, you know, there's other kinds of life support technology, too. It gets very subtle. What if you need pills to stay alive every day? Or what if you need dialysis? These are all life support technologies. What we're not told when we're hospitalized is that providers view life support technology in three ways. One of them is just like we do. It's life support. It's applied in an out-and-out emergency, and you'll die without it. Another is treatment, and this is where it gets real blurry. Some providers, and you have to ask because each doctor will have a different viewpoint. Some providers will say, well, yeah, it's life support technology, but it's part of treatment. And if we're going down a curative path and we have treatment goals, that implies approval of the introduction and maintenance of life support under certain medical conditions. And thirdly, life support is literally standard operating procedure. That is, when we go under general anesthesia, guess what? We're intubated. It's the equivalent of basically turning the body half off and using the machinery to maintain it so that they can make incisions and go inside our bodies and fix them. And then they basically turn the rest of the body back on and eventually take you off life support.
Yeah.
So it's a huge gray zone.
It is a gray zone. Of course, all this kind of pathway that a person can go through while they're in hospital, and of course, the issues surrounding dying, the option to die in peace or the option to die at home or whatever, and this is something that people have to come up against, too, in many cases. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes, I can. The option to die in peace came to me at a very quiet moment. You know, writing a book takes a couple of years. And I was sitting here about two-thirds of the way into the process, and I just stopped. And it dawned on me, as enunciating and refining the expression of all what it takes, what's 150, 200 pages worth of writing about how to manage hospitalization. And all of a sudden I stopped, and I thought, the most effective way to manage a terminal hospitalization is not to have one. Right?
Right.
Don't go. But how on earth do you do that? What kind of personal mojo is required to get to that place? It happened that during this time, the state of Colorado had formed a health care reform commission. The legislature passed a bill. The governor signed it a year and a half ago. It was called the 208 Health Care Reform Commission. That was the Senate bill number. And the commission had set out a call for proposals, for health care reform proposals statewide. And all of a sudden, almost coincident with that thought, that the most effective way to manage a terminal hospitalization is not to go, all of a sudden, you know, I said, what do we want? You know, we all know that 80% of Americans, when asked, say they want to die in peace at home. Yet the data is that 50% of Americans die in hospitals, which are command-control institutions, where death is viewed by the providers as a professional and personal failure. Another 20% die in nursing homes. And of the remainder, those who die in hospice, and by the way, it's probably more than 30% because a lot of people go to hospice for what we call active dying. They don't really use hospice for all what it is, which is kind of a luxury model of dying. Mm-hmm. In terms of the care that you receive. But people will go to hospice maybe, you know, they'll stay in a hospital for 3 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever it is, and then they'll go to hospice and die a few days later. So they've essentially experienced a hospitalized demise. But of those who use hospice, well, that's what I was going to say, that 33% of people who die in hospice have only been there for 4 to 7 days, right, which is... You know, hospice provides so much to families, not just the patient, that, you know, that's all essentially a lot of what hospice offers, and you're not going to get it in 4 to 7 days. It's not enough time to die peacefully as a patient family. That's a hybrid term that I developed because while the patient is the one who receives medical treatment, the family is such an intrinsic part of this,
yes,
part of the treatment if you're in the hospital. And let me give you a metaphor. I liken death to a one-way mirror. And when our loved one dies, they go beyond the glass.
Yeah.
We can't see them. It's smoky. We can't reach. We try. We stand there. And, you know, metaphorically, we stand there with our being, and we want to reach through and touch them and be with them and stay with them. We can't go. We don't get to go. But it's a one-way mirror. And if we look at it, what do we see reflected behind us? We see our experiences of our loved one's demise. We see the patient family's experience, right, metaphorically. If you're in a hospital, you may see a long hall. And
right.
Given our healthcare system, that hall is littered with $1,000 bills. And if you look ahead, if you're a policymaker, you see tens of thousands of boomers lining, queuing up in that hall because the baby boomers are now turning 60, and in 10 years they're going to be 70.
Right.
They're going to start dying generationally. Well, so what happens is if you talk to anyone, you've probably had this experience, I would bet you. You talk to somebody who's lost a loved one. It could be years later. And all of a sudden, they begin remembering. And it's powerful. It's strong. If it was good, they feel warm. Yes, we feel the loss. But if it was a peaceful, good demise, then there's warm memories. And if it was a bad, problematic, or even horrific demise, there's anger, there's angst, there's unresolved stuff, and it's right there. It comes up immediately as if we have just lived it yesterday. It could be years old.
Mm-hmm.
So this is extremely powerful stuff. So the option to die in peace is but two things. It's a policy proposal that, long story short, is intended to widen an alternative pathway to hospitalized dying, to make it easier for individuals to opt into hospice sooner than we can right now. Socially, the option to die in peace is a tool for patient families, for we the people, to examine our choices, and if we want to, come to a conclusion that says, you know what, I'm not going to go. And it would be an ethically sound conclusion. I should say that PEACE is an acronym, which stands for Patient Ethical Alternative Care Elective.
Right.
Where patient is the person.
Yes.
And it also implies that we're patient, we're not in a hurry.
Yes.
Alternative speaks for itself. So does ethical, I think. But it's important because there are things we have to parse in our minds and hearts that may feel ethically questionable. And we might come to the conclusion, as I have, that they are quite ethically sound. Care, true care, not treatment, right? Not being fodder for a medical system or undergoing, you know, a potpourri of futile intervention, but care. And then elective. It's not a dictum. It's not a law. It is an option that we each can choose once we know how to weigh the benefit versus burden you know, of hospitalization at end of life versus staying home or going
right.
to hospice.
Well, this book that you've written, Bart, is very, very complete in all these areas, and I know that you've been through it, and I know that you've just done an awful lot of ruminating on how the whole system works, and it's a very, I recommend the book very highly for people who, actually anyone, is probably at some time of their life going to go through parts of this, parts of the details in this book. But having gone through it yourself, can you, you probably have some points of view on what doesn't work today and what should be changed. And could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. And you know what? I want to start with the provider side. I actually include 13 or 14 reform proposals. And some of them have to do with the provider side. You know, we have docs who are trained. Essentially, unfortunately, their humanity is almost drained out of them, and the rest could be drained out of them because of what it takes to practice medicine under the unbelievable constraints that these folks have today with the corporatization of hospitals and the insurance imperatives and on and on. That's a whole nother conversation. But my compassion has grown for the providers. They're in a rough position. They have a kaleidoscope of patient families that continually come into their orbit. They don't know what cultural background, what orientation, whether the family is functional or dysfunctional, you know, they're gonna serve next. It's a tough row to hoe for these folks. That said, when doctors' primary orientation is to cure rather than to help us leave the world if it is our time, then I think a couple of things. First of all, they should say so. And if our primary orientation is that we want to be cured, even if we're 96 years old and we probably can't be cured, but we want to try to be cured, then we need to be real clear about that too. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is that those are the default standpoints that we engage in the hospital from. But they're not enunciated. They're not articulated. And this becomes an issue for those of us who decide, no, that's not what we want. And remember, 80% of Americans say they want to die at home in peace. Yet so many of us end up in the hospital. We go in without questioning what is actually happening. So I say, you know what, on the medical side, we should change the way deaths are recorded. Those doctors who want to focus on curative, who are really uncomfortable helping people leave the planet naturally, right? I'm not saying physician-assisted anything. I'm saying, okay, you're not going to make it. Ma'am or sir, I'm very sorry to bear this news, but you're not going to make it. Let's provide comfort care. Let's not do all these things to you for 3 or 4 weeks to see if maybe you can, when in my professional judgment, you probably won't. Mm-hmm. And I say doctors should say that, right? But those families who want to go the curative track should also say that too. And then when the deaths are recorded, they should be recorded under a separate category, right? The category that says we wanted to fight to the nines, and as long as society is willing to pay for it on a policy level, the docs are going to do it, and we're going to do it, and the hospitals will record the deaths that way, and they won't accrue to anybody's negative statistics. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's one piece. Another piece, and it's huge, is to realize, and this may sound shocking, but death is timed in hospitals. There's something called an insurance imperative. You have to progress or regress in today's hospitalization. There are no death watches like there were in the mid-20th century in hospitals. You have to have a treatment code. And if you don't get better or worse, they're going to boot you out to somewhere, rehab, back home, who knows. But this has been studied. Sharon Kaufman in San Francisco wrote a fascinating book called Anna Time to Die. It was a 2-year study. She's an RN, an ethicist. An RN anthropologist, a medical anthropologist. And she was the ultimate fly on the wall. And this was one of her conclusions. And as I experienced it, yeah, I can understand. Death is managed in the hospitals. And Kaufman went further, said death is timed. And this has to do with the providers waiting for the patient family to come to conclude for themselves that, no, my loved one is not going to make it out of here. It's time to stop all this intervention. Right. Now, the providers may have known this for some weeks, but they don't want to be accused of abandoning the patient family, so they may hold their assessment in reserve. So in terms of what we need to understand to manage an end-of-life scenario is this whole potpourri of things that we need to know to manage a hospitalization, to understand how death unfolds in hospital hallways by default, and then we can say, well, time out. If my death is going to be managed or timed in a hospital, I'm going to have all these agonizing experiences that personally as a patient, I don't want to endure. And as the family, I don't want to remember. It's not the memories I want to have of my loved one's end days. I would rather commune with my loved one.
I think that's very important, actually.
Yeah. You know, not deal with the system. Then we have a framework. So what's left, Jake? What's left, if we want to opt out, is fear. And what are we afraid of? We're afraid of pain. We're afraid of the lack of loss of dignity and control. And we're afraid of dying and death.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the good news is that palliative care, whether it's provided by hospitals, and this is an emerging specialty, mm-hmm. end-of-life palliative care, or whether it's provided by hospice, pain can be managed. It can be managed well. It actually has become the fifth vital sign legally. The medical powers that be in America have recognized pain as the fifth vital sign, right? There's blood pressure, you know, pulse, respiration, whatever, and pain is now the fifth one.
Mm.
So if you get past those problems, then the question is, well, am I afraid of dying and death? And for me, I said, holy moly, they're going to time my death in a hospital. Why should I let these guys time my death? Now, I'm not trying to paint them as bad. You know, these folks are not bad people. Everyone's trying to do the best they can do.
No, you're talking about empowerment, though.
Yes. So the piece is that we, the people, need to sit down and start talking. We all need to talk, right? The docs need to talk to us. We need to talk to the docs. We need to talk amongst ourselves. And what I suggest is that we get this unspoken thing off our backs and try it on for size. Mm-hmm. Have a conversation about what's going to happen to all of us. And what I found over the years of writing the book, you may tell that I'm comfortable speaking of these things, about my own parents' demises and my experience of them, because I have looked at it face on, close, for 3 years. And what happens is that you gain an appreciation of life and living.
Sure you do.
Right?
Yeah.
Get this thing off your back. You loosen your jaw. You loosen your shoulders. You know what I'm saying? So that's it in a nutshell. You know, we do these things and we examine what is in these institutions, what the likelihood of experiencing these problems that so many of us do experience, and therefore, if we don't want to do them, how can we opt out? And then do we have the support structures at home to stay at home? Otherwise, we would go to a hospice facility.
Exactly. Well, there are just so many things in the book that you've notated that people who get your book are going to be at least have something to hang on to as they go through the experiences that you've been through and have a heads up on a lot of things and a lot of decisions that they'll be asked to make. And I find that you've done a wonderful job in the book. But you also have a downloadable book, Settling the Family Estate?
Yeah, it's called How to Efficiently Settle the Family Estate. And thank you for remembering that. The interesting thing is that if your loved one happens to be, in my case, your second parent, or perhaps a spouse, then it doesn't end, when you walk out of the hospital. You have business to do. You have an estate to settle. This was originally conceived, I conceived this as being the last chapter in the book, but I quickly realized that I couldn't mix these two topics in a book. The book would have been too long. We can't even go into all, there are so many things I wish I would have time to say in our brief conversation about the medical piece. So the money piece is a different piece. It's a 70-page downloadable book. And the issues are the same, Jake. It essentially, it's so simple, and it's so difficult. Adequate communication in advance of when we need it. And unfortunately, again, nobody's trying to be bad or mean, but my experience in settling my family estate was that I had to learn as I went. And people who have done this time and time again on the, what I'll call the provider side, right, the financial institution, the representatives you talk to on the phone, they don't tell you things that could help you out. You have to dig and dig and dig and dig. And there's so much stuff to know that I said, I'm going to write this up too. And again, it's crucial because it happens right on the heels of a loved one dying. Now, if you have a parent who dies and the mortgage is paid off and the home is in town or an hour away, there's no need to sell it. There's no need to move fast. Well, there's no law that says you can't just hang out and pay the property taxes and settle the estate whenever you feel like it. But if, in my case, my dad was down in South Florida and, you know, it's I live in Denver or Boulder, so it's, you know, 4 hours airtime to get there, I couldn't fly back and forth. So I actually, once we knew that Dad was going to die, that he made the decision to go in hospice, we had to make the choice to pull his heart meds after he was in hospice. But, you know, he was going to die. That was it. There was no back and, you know, out. There was no fix to be had. I needed to start settling the estate while he was in hospice. It's a very, very hard thing to do.
Well, our time is getting short, Bart, but I'd like to thank you so much for coming to Authors Audio today to talk about your book. And I think you have at least one website, don't you?
Yes, I do. And I'd actually like to give several URLs.
That's fine.
For the website. One is waitingroombook.com.
Okay, waitingroombook.com.
Another is waitingroombook.com. Another is notesfromthewaitingroom.com. And finally, my name, bartwindrum.com. All three will get you there.
You've got the waterfront covered there, Bart.
And you have been listening to another Authors Audio program with author Bart Windrum and Notes from the Waiting Room. And I hope you all drop into authorsaudio.com and listen to our other broadcasts. And until next time, this is Jake D. Steele, and keep dreaming and happy reading. Bye for now.